The next matter on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-01, Stop This Insanity. Nice title. Mr. Backer's with us today. Why don't you join us in the event that there are questions for you?
Good morning.
Good morning. We have a presentation from the Office of General Counsel from Mr. David Adkins.
Thank you, Chair Hunter, and good morning, Commissioners. Agenda documents 12-13 and 12-13A respond to an advisory opinion request submitted by Counsel for Stop This Insanity Incorporated, or STI, regarding the activities of its connected committee, the STI Employee Leadership Fund, or ELF. The request asks whether ELF may establish a non-contribution account into which it would solicit unlimited contributions from all STI employees and the general public for the purpose of financing independent expenditures. The request also asks how ELF would need to report payments it receives from STI for the establishment, administration, and solicitation costs associated with this non-contribution account. Draft A concludes that ELF may establish the non-contribution account and solicit unlimited contributions from the general public and STI's restricted class without limitation. Solicitations directed at other STI employees, however, would still be subject to twice-yearly solicitation restrictions. Further, Draft A concludes that payments by ELF for the establishment, administration, and solicitation costs associated with this account would not be contributions and wouldn't need to be reported. Draft B concludes that the Act and Commission regulations prohibit STI and ELF's plan to establish such a non-contribution account. The draft states that to the extent STI would like to solicit unlimited funds from the general public for the purpose of financing independent expenditures, it may do so without the use of its connected committee. We didn't receive any comments on the request, and we didn't receive any comments on the drafts. And as always, we're happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Adkins. Any questions or comments? Commissioner McGann.
The question I have really is why? If you have a corporation, Stop This Insanity Inc., right, your parent organization, that can already spend unlimited money, raise unlimited money to do ads, but it seems like you want to run that through the already existing PAC. I could guess at the answer. You don't want the whole thing to become a political committee, and you're willing to sign up for the political committee reporting obligations to keep it separate. Maybe it relieves the burden. I don't know. But my initial reaction when I read the request is why? Is there burdens here? Is there things? Because I'm leaning towards draft A. Not leaning. I'm at draft A. But I'm curious as to why we're putting a fine point on this when there's other ways to, I think, maybe do this. But maybe as a practical matter, there aren't other ways to do it.
Well, in terms of the why, Stop This Insanity Inc. is a 501c4 organization, and in analyzing their exempt purpose and how they choose to operate and what they choose to do, independent expenditures, we don't believe, necessarily further that exempt purpose. And so the organization doesn't feel that it's appropriate for them to engage in independent expenditures. And as a policy matter, said, look, we're not going to do this out of our 501c4. But the individual employees of Stop This Insanity Inc. are very politically motivated and very politically involved and want to engage in these activities collectively and with others. And so doing so through the vehicle of the Employee Leadership Fund, ELF, seemed like the appropriate way to go forward while also furthering the goal of disclosing political contributions. It's not lost to us that 501c4s don't disclose their donors, and that's led to a certain amount of public approbation for 501c4s that are in any way involved politically, and we're seeking to do so in a manner that prevents our organization from being chastised in the public or penalized for the political involvement of its employees. And as a practical matter, the organization only has, I think, four or five donors in excess of $5,000 to the entire organization, and has, I think, 50 to 60,000 donors at an average of $45 a pop. So disclosing all those donors would be incredibly burdensome for them. if they were trying to do this through the C4 and also hoping to further the disclosure goals of the commission.
So actually you're going to have more disclosure by running this through the existing PAC and having the separate account within the existing PAC to do unlimited IEs, because otherwise the folks who give money to the C4, employees of the C4, whatever, wouldn't have to be known. But the money that's actually going to be spent on the campaign-related ads are going to be disclosed because you're trying to run it through the PAC.
Right. And if they weren't running it through the internal or the ELF, they would run it through some other outside entity. It isn't a question of, well, should we run it through STI as the legal entity or not. There's zero interest in doing so because we're not sure it furthers the exempt purpose. We understand the value of disclosure in independent expenditure activities, and we don't want to face the burden of having to disclose everybody's contributions to the C4 just to disclose, right. You know, because there's only a few people maybe or a few entities involved in the actual independent expenditure component of the activity.
So I guess you already have existing PAC. You could set up maybe a second PAC and endure that burden, but that seems to be
burdensome.
National Defense PAC carry two.
Exactly. And since everyone who would be contributing to the carry account of ELF would be able to do this if it were a separate outside entity, the disclosure goals, we think, are furthered, and the burden is reduced by having ELF have a second bank account, a carry account, in order to engage in the independent expenditure activity that they and that the employees and those who share their views would like to engage in, separate from the traditional PAC account activities.
Let me the one thing I liked about the draft, and I want to thank OGC for this, I think they got it right, and maybe I'm going to live to regret this, but help me out here, the solicitation restrictions, right? That there's another, it's not just an accruttment appearance, or it's how often people get solicited and whatnot. I think the analysis in that was spot on, and I think that's right. But I'll give Mr. Backer a chance to talk me out of it. Draft A still has you still have some hoops you have to jump through, and you still have some restrictions. Am I right to say that those are still on the books and are justified by other?
In terms of the solicitation restrictions, our concern there flows like this. If we're soliciting the general public for contributions to the carry account of ELF, and the other employees are part of that, you know, because they're also part of the general public and see the ads that we're putting up online or whatnot, they're going to essentially be solicited as part of the general public, not as incident to their employment. And so I don't know if it's going to be an issue, but I see the potential issue there.
I think the draft anticipates that, and I think it reflects that, right? Right. It's to me, when I read it, it's kind of by analogy. If you have a federal Air Force base in your district, right, you can't solicit the federal employees on the base, but if they happen to be on your list and it's a generalized, right, because the point of the restriction is to avoid the sort of one-on-one shakedown of people who may not really want to give, but they feel they have to give either because their job depends on it or whatnot. But if it's a generalized solicitation, I think that's covered. Let me check with counsel. I think everyone's nodding, but let's just make sure I'm right on that. Is that right, either Mr. Dealer or Mr. Atkins?
My concern would be if we're looking at the anti-shakedown rationale against soliciting them more than twice a year, it's not that these non-restricted class employees are certainly going to be aware of the solicitations going on, and they're going to know that they're out there in the general public. Some of them, and either they all want to contribute, none of them want to contribute, or some of them want to contribute, but how that ultimately plays out could lead us to trouble down the road. Let's say all of them want to contribute and do in response to general public solicitations. Then it creates a fact pattern that at least objectively looks like, wait, are you actually secretly kind of pushing your employees to do this or not?
Right, I understand it. But I think the draft anticipates that and gives you the protection from a backdoor MERS questioning whether or not they really just spontaneously gave or you sort of pushed them to give, right? I mean, is that right, counsel?
Right, yeah, that's addressed in footnote 15 of draft A, which we thought was analogous to the same sort of situation when you have employees of a corporation outside the restricted class who are nevertheless shareholders and can be solicited in that capacity.
At least I read the AO as covering that potential eventuality. If someone files a complaint, I would see this AO as protecting you. Now, if the facts are different, obviously that's a different situation, but it sounds like you're not playing with the facts. You feel like you don't want to be wrongly accused of something that didn't happen. I think the, and that's why I appreciate counsel, you know, seeing the issue, and I think the analysis in that area is right, and it's good. So I can support draft A, and I think that's all I have for Mr. Backer, and appreciate you coming and answering my questions.
Thank you.
I just add, they could solicit, the employees could have contributed through the twice yearly, as a result of the twice yearly solicitations anyways, so it's not like they would be contributing just because they received the solicitations that went to the general public.
And if they contribute in response to a twice yearly, and then, I don't know, halfway between the twice yearly they give on their own, that doesn't raise any sort of issues. This AO contemplates that, correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only question that I have is, I'm just trying to get a better sense of the organization. How many employees are there?
About 15 to 20, I'd say, at any given time. And I hope they obviously want to continue to grow as an organization, be more effective, and have more employees.
Just trying to get a better sense of the scope of this. From my perspective, the question really comes down to, I think the key distinction between these two drafts comes down to two sentences. In draft A, find the right sentence. Draft A on page 8 says, although adjudication of constitutionality is generally outside an administrative agency's authority, see Johnson v. Robeson, the commission is not required to enforce restrictions where they rest on principles plainly determined by the courts to be unconstitutional. Draft B says, because no court has invalidated the contribution limits and prohibitions and accompanying solicitation restrictions for SSFs on constitutional grounds, we are required to give full force to the Act and the Commission's regulations, citing Johnson v. Robeson, adjudication of constitutionality is generally outside an administrative agency's authority. Even Draft A concedes this is a case of first impression. And on a case of first impression, you know, I guess reasonable minds can disagree as to whether judicial decisions compel us to reach this conclusion in a case of first impression. Obviously, because it's a case of first impression, no judge has spoken to this issue. Given that no judge has spoken to this issue, I feel that that's a decision that's basically above my pay grade. Whether what you are asking will serve the interests of disclosure or not, I think, given that whatever principle we might establish here will be applied broadly, you know, it doesn't really depend on your individual goals and what, you know, you intend to do in terms of disclosure. I mean, I think the thousands of $45 contributors are kind of a red herring because they wouldn't be disclosed in any circumstances. We don't disclose contributors unless they give at least $200. So that's neither here nor there. I could certainly see an entity setting itself up, taking advantage of this to basically, really all they have is the SSF, and then they set up a shell corporation to go along with it. I'm not saying this is what you're doing. I'm just saying this would be something that would be possible, depending on how we rule here, so that all of the money would be raised by the C4, and then all the SSF would be disclosed would be one big donation from the C4, and there would be no disclosure. So I think the disclosure could go either way. This is not necessarily a pro-disclosure or necessarily an anti-disclosure decision. I just think that it's capable of being used either way. And as I said, I think that the decision to decide constitutionality is one that is vested in the courts, not in the commission. As I said, reasonable minds could disagree as to whether what the courts have already have said mandates this conclusion as the natural follow-on. I have, you know, I've seen people say, well, of course the next decision is going to say yes, going to say this, and then be wrong. I mean, a lot of people thought after Wisconsin Right to Life, for example, that the natural consequence of that was going to be there would be no disclosure of anything beyond the functional equivalent of express advocacy, and the court pretty much laid that to rest in Citizens United, that that was not, in fact, the natural follow-on. So I think particularly in a case like this where there really is not an additional burden. We're not saying, unlike Carrie, we're not saying you have to set up a new organization. You've got the organization. You've got the corporation. The corporation can speak for itself. The SSF can speak for itself. We're not imposing any additional burdens on you. Functionally, the same people, can run it. It's just a question of where the bank account is going to be housed, because really we're talking about a bank account here. We're not really talking about a separate organization at all. So given all that, I'll be supporting Draft B.
Commissioner McGinn?
Let's say you do this out of the C4 and set aside the tax issues. You only have a handful of employees. You're not that large. And you start doing independent expenditures. Is this really just about where the bank account's housed? I mean, couldn't your whole thing become a political committee at some point? Particularly the way the commission sort of has a case by case, there's no way you're going to know. So to say there's no burden, that just doesn't make any sense, and it's completely counter to what you've already said. I mean, I don't want you to admit you could be a political committee in the abstract, because your instinct is to say no, but for the sake of argument, isn't that a very real potential?
Well, for the sake
that at least the FEC could say you might be, and you'd have to endure an investigation and take it to court to prove you're not?
That's certainly a possibility that has crossed our minds, and we'd rather take the safer approach and avoid the enormous potential costs of an enforcement action and having this looked at. But also, on a fundamental level, the corporation doesn't want to speak and shouldn't be forced to. If employees want to speak, they want to speak with other people. They want to do it in a manner that aligns with the values and the vision of the organization. But the organization itself simply doesn't want to speak.
And the people in the organization that don't want to speak would probably really be upset if they woke up and realized that they're now a political committee in the eyes of the FEC.
And that would be a significant problem. And there are probably employees who don't want to speak or want to speak differently than the organization. So by separating the independent expenditure activity from the organization, there's this value of the people who want to speak can speak with the people they want to speak with, and the organization that doesn't want to speak isn't forced to speak. It just makes more sense, and the people who want to speak are able to do so.
Right. The thing about Draft B that struck me was this idea that when you set up an SSF, somehow that's some magic, special, benevolent status that the government has given you, and therefore you're essentially forfeiting rights that you'd otherwise have if you weren't an SSF. That just doesn't make any sense to me at all. It seems to me that this is no different than the Carey situation, and the SSF issue is kind of a red herring. I think it does illustrate, though, two diametrically opposed points of view. And the one view that Draft B, I think, takes is that the default is that we have an ability to regulate, and that only stops when the courts carve out a specific exception, First Amendment or maybe the statute. The other point of view is that the general rule is you can do what you want, and thanks to Buckley, there's an area where the FEC can regulate. And all this recent case law has merely shrunken the zone that the FEC can occupy when it comes to regulation. So to me, when you take that road, it's not hard to say the Carey case governs here, because that all these cases have shrunk the ability of the FEC. So it's not that we're playing judge, which brings me to my second point. It's that the commission, in the first instance, is the one tasked with interpreting the statute. And unless we do it in a way that's contrary to law, I don't see why we can't say the statute doesn't reach, the contribution limit issue doesn't reach this kind of account, and construe the statute in a way that avoids the issue. Now, maybe that doesn't survive Chevron 1 in other instances. I think it probably does, and once we get Chevron 2, we're home free. So it's not that we're up here playing judges. It's that we're actually realizing the limits of our jurisdiction. There's the other point of view that says until a court actually strikes a specific provision, we have to keep going. The problem with that is the FEC has been doing that for years, and now we have a mount in the case law that's really, in my view, the result of this. I've already spoken on this. It's well known that me and others have the view that it's been sometimes the overreach that has caused the problem. And I feel like here we go again. But we'll see. You know, you can always say, who knows what's going to happen tomorrow, and be safe, because it is true, who knows what's going to happen tomorrow. But I know what's happened yesterday, and when there is this mechanical application of things in the face of what seems to be controlling case law, meaning the principles articulated limiting the jurisdiction of the agency, when the agency blows through those things, it doesn't seem to end well. And I'm not entirely sure that the view of B is one that's consistently applied. I've seen other instances where things are struck by courts, but then other courts say things, and then dicta is used to revive things that other courts have struck, and there is this sort of three-card money that goes on. So I'm not sure that there's sort of a purity of B across the board. But I certainly, in this case, understand why if somebody were going to consistently do that. Commissioner Walther, for example, takes this view quite often. There is an intellectual consistency there, but I don't see that sort of consistency across the board generally, that there's sort of this humility of, well, we can't really go and say that you can do unlimited in a separate account because, well, that part of the statute hasn't been struck. Well, you know, I guess, but you can say, well, Emily's List didn't address it because that wasn't the issue in Emily's List. It's not that Emily's List didn't address it. It's just that wasn't the kind of committee at issue. So it's not easy, but I don't know. I'm on draft A. I think this is already kind of decided, and you're just here to make sure that you have some cover. But you can set up a separate account and do unlimited IEs, and I don't see how being an SSF changes the analysis at all.
Commissioner Bowerly?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to jump. Commissioner Peterson, did you? Oh, okay, sorry. I think the challenge here is that I'm going to take a little bit of issue with the way my colleague was describing sort of the other view, if I might. My view is that we have a statute on the books, we have regulations on the books, and it is the agency's role to uphold those and enforce those until someone who either writes the law like Congress changes them, or a court who interprets the law in terms of constitutional scrutiny changes them for Congress and for us. And with respect to what we're dealing with here, SSFs, and the reason that non-connected was so specifically discussed in terms of how the commission was going to respond to Kerry was because, at least for some of us, this issue has not yet been addressed. And SSFs are different from non-connected PACs. There's a slew of pieces of the statute and regulations as described in Draft B that address their particular role in this whole scheme. And we don't have any cases that clearly govern the question of whether SSFs may form separate accounts for IE activity. SSFs, of course, are as an entity of the corporation. And in Citizens United, the court found that it wasn't sufficient to tell a corporation they had to speak through their SSF, that instead they could speak through, they could do directly. But it's not clear to me that any of the cases that have come before, whether it's Citizens United or SpeechNow or Kerry, address the issue that whether an SSF itself has any constitutional rights that need to be vindicated by having its own account. So I think there is I actually take very seriously my particular role, and I try to approach it every day with humility of what this particular agency has to do. And if my colleague thinks I'm inconsistent, I actually think I've been fairly inconsistent, and I've frequently, and I think most on these types of issues, have always voted with Commissioner Walther. So I do look to his analysis quite frequently on these types of issues. So I think that's where we are. And I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but I know what happened on Monday. And on Monday, the Supreme Court rejected a cert petition coming out of the First Circuit regarding the scope of a Maine law governing political activity that was a little bit broader than what the Supreme Court has previously discussed in a major purpose. And, of course, denial of cert is just denial of cert. But that, I think, along with the Court's recent decision not to hear a case in Blumen and summarily affirm the lower court, I think it is very difficult to predict, particularly in this area of the law, what any particular court will do next. So it's not my job to decide the constitutionality of particular provisions of our statute. There are a number of specific provisions at issue here that have not recently been addressed by courts to cause any suspicion of them in any way. So I'll be voting for Draft B. Thank you.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that this request, it presents a matter of a first impression to the extent that it is true that the cases that we've been talking about, CU, Speech Now, Emily's List, and Kerry, didn't specifically address SSFs. However, I think to the extent that the principles that are enunciated in those cases, I don't see anything in those that limit their reasoning just to non-connected PACs. I think they're equally applicable to SSFs. I see, you know, kind of two potential outcomes that could result if we were to not grant the request that that Mr. Backers brought forward. If the Commission concludes that this organization cannot run IEs through its SSF, meaning that they cannot take unlimited contributions from corporations, labor unions, and individuals to run IEs, then let's say that you indicate that that the organization staff, this insanity, does not wish to run it through the corporation. But let's just assume, what if they did, and it did trigger major purpose? Now they would be required to register as a non-connected PAC in order to engage in the sort of IE activity that we were just mentioning. And so if the organization wanted to engage in both direct contributions to candidates and engage in independent expenditures using, again, unlimited corporate union and individual money, they would have to set up two separate committees to do so, which seems to run us headlong into the Kerry case, which said that requiring organizations to set up two separate committees to engage in both contribution activity and independent expenditure activity was an unconstitutional burden. So that's one fork in the road. The other would be if you run it through, if you were to run your independent expenditure activity through the corporation, but let's say that you didn't trigger major purpose, didn't become a political committee, the consequence of that would be much less disclosure. The only thing you would have to disclose is those who gave money for the purpose of running particular ads. And with respect to the rank-and-file employees of Stop This Insanity, there would be no protection that they would have from solicitations, twice yearly solicitation of those individuals who are in the non-restricted class. There are limitations on, you know, those have to be written. There have to be mechanisms in place so that they can give anonymously if under $50. Those sorts of protections would not be in place for employees if the corporation were running their IE activity through the corporation itself. They could have face-to-face meetings and frankly the anti-coercion provisions that are included in 114.6 of 11 CFR are only applicable to when the PAC is soliciting. And so again, those protections that normally apply in the SSF context wouldn't necessarily apply if the independent expenditures were run through the corporation. So, again, I see this as I'm on draft day. I support draft day. I think that, I find myself ironically in the position of supporting greater disclosure and more and. And also looking out for the little guy, the rank and file guy, and the organization who could be potentially subjected to more coercive solicitation methods. So either again, I see either we're running down the road of running headlong into Kerry and having a problem constitutionally, or we're going down a road where there would be much less disclosure and much a much greater potential for shakedowns of rank-and-file employees. So I think that the proposal that that Mr. Backer has put forward and has put forward before the commission in its request, I think is justified by the relevant case law, and the practical effects of that decision, I think, are actually salutary as well. So I think it's a win-win on both sides. But that's the long and short of why I'm going to be supporting Draft Day.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And based upon what Commissioner Peterson said, I almost feel inclined to vote with him just to see him in the new arena and see how I feel about that.
It's great.
But for the reasons stated by Commissioner McGann, I plan to vote for Draft B.
Which one did you say, Steve?
B.
Oh, okay. Commissioner McGann.
It's like I'm dictating statements of reasons for the other side. And I have my friend Commissioner Peterson sounding downright progressive. Three things. First, the argument that, well, there's a statute on the books and that's what we need to do, I guess that works sometimes, but the reality is, if that were the case, we wouldn't be having a meeting because we're still waiting for the ex officio members to show up, and that's actually still on the books. Now, the D.C. Circuit struck it, but, well, what if we're not in the D.C. Circuit? I mean, maybe the ex officio should still be here. So there's a lot of things that are on the books. But agencies, and not just the FEC, state agencies and campaign finance routinely say, in their discretion, we're going to take a second look, or we're going to figure out what this means, or we're not going to enforce this. And that's actually not revolutionary or beyond the pale. Second, the idea that there isn't any really controlling case law and that this is a complete new issue, first impression, you really have to read it hyper-technically, I think, to get there, and that's a point I think I heard Commissioner Peterson just making. At the end of the day, remember CalMed. The way I read the opinion, that was an SSF. And we know what CalMed means because the D.C. Circuit has told us what CalMed means via Emily's List, and we kind of know what CalMed means because SpeechNow told us. So to say that there's no law out there and this has never come up isn't really true because, well, it has. And remember, CalMed, four justices upheld contribution limits, but the swing vote, Justice Blackmun said, not if it was for independent expenditures. So the Supremes have never upheld it. The lower courts are the ones that have dealt with this. And because it's become circular. Emily's List didn't deal with an SSF, therefore it doesn't count. But Emily's List used a case that was concerning an SSF to get to the conclusion for non-SSFs. So to me, we're really, really skating on thin ice to say that somehow the FEC's hands are tied and that there's some sort of justification for the position here. But, you know, maybe we'll find out. I had a third point, but frankly, I've forgotten it. And I think we all know where we are, so there's really no point in prolonging it. And I yield back, and thanks for the time.
Any other questions or comments? Is there a motion? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move approval of agenda document number 12-13, draft A, with respect to draft advisory opinion 2012-01.
Commissioner McGann.
It's germane to the motion. It's my third point. I just remembered it. The cert denied case, that really to me has absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about here today. But to be clear, that case, the First Circuit case, makes clear that the Supreme Court's construction of FICA in Buckley is a statutory construction. McConnell said this. First Circuit had already said that was the case for 100.22b, and they made clear the major purpose component was also a statutory construction. It's not some free-floating constitutional rule that we get to grapple with. So cert was denied, that's true. It certainly lets state legislatures try again and come up with more expansive disclosure regimes. I have no idea what that case has to do with what we're talking about here today and how that somehow changes what the FEC can do. On the contrary, it makes clear that what the FEC can do is exactly what Buckley said it can do. And not only that, it resolves the issue that it's a case of statutory construction, not constitutional amorphousness. And I intend on still supporting draft A for the reasons Commissioner Walter didn't say.
Okay. There's a motion on the table. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Did you say
aye? Okay. You said aye. All those opposed?
No.
The motion fails 3-3. Commissioner Peterson, Commissioner McGann, and the chair voted yes, and the vice chair, Commissioner Walter, and Commissioner Bowerly voted no. Any other motions? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I move, I just want to compliment Commissioner Peterson, who always expresses his views on the law without ever casting aspersions on anybody else's intellectual honesty or consistency, and I've always appreciated that about working with you. You should support disclosure more often. You might like it. I move that we adopt Draft B.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion fails 3-3, and the vote is reversed from the last one. Yes, Mr. Backer.
I'm not sure if it's appropriate to say at this point, but I did want to bring it up in the earlier conversation. But Vice Chair Weintraub made a comment I'd like to comment upon.
Sure.
You indicated that you weren't sure about the disclosure burden related to having disclosed all the $45 donors, that the average $45 donor, these tens of thousands of people. And this is an issue that came up the last time I was here, that I think the commission may want to start looking at reporting and disclosure as two separate burdens. Disclosing those donors isn't the burden. Reporting them and recording them is, because we'd have to enter every one of those people into FEC. If we were a political committee or if we were disclosing our contributions, all those potential donors would have to be entered into some sort of reporting software in order to keep an eye out for aggregation limits. And so it's not so much that the disclosure is a problem, it's that the burden of trying to do all that reporting, particularly with grassroots-driven organizations, just becomes really, really burdensome. I just thought that it's something that it's not germane to the last motion, but I thought it was something that ought to be looked at, perhaps, or considered by the commission.
Thank you, Mr. Backer. Any comments? Excellent. Thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you.